anti-pollution programs around the Mississippi River are having a tough time getting the job done. They're not addressing a growing problem with water pollution. Studies tell us this. Environmental groups are well aware. We're looking at partnerships and policies that are cropping up around an effort to decrease nutrient pollution in the Great River that rises from Lake Itasca in Minnesota and flows southward to the Gulf of Mexico. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jamie Konopacki is an attorney and watershed policy specialist who facilitates partnerships that aim to decrease nutrient pollution. She's worked with the City of Green Bay. She was a fellow at Harvard Law School's Environmental Policy Initiative, where she helped the U.S. Senate Agriculture Committee revise conservation planning in the most recent farm bill. Jamie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So help us with some context here. Have we always had nutrient pollution in our river, or has it really increased over time? What do the trend lines tell us?
So I think we've always had nutrient pollution, nutrient runoff. Nutrients come from municipal sewage treatment plants. They also come from agriculture. And I think a lot of people are acutely aware of agriculture and some of the increasing size of farms that we've been seeing over the years. And that certainly means an increased amount of nutrients on the land. And even in the best cases and on the best managed farms, rainfall is still going to carry nutrients. So it's always been a challenge, but as city populations grow and as farms grow.
So we have the sewage treatment plants, we have the agricultural runoff, stormwater. How does residential and commercial development fit into the pollution issue?
So we have kind of three or four main categories of players or sources of nutrient pollution. We have the runoff from farms, and we have the runoff from municipal areas, and we also have the discharges from municipal treatment plants. So as cities get larger and we have more yards and more paved areas, we have greater runoff from those areas.
And if you decrease wetlands, if you fill wetlands, that has an impact as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Wetlands can act as sinks for nitrogen and phosphorus. They can essentially hold those nutrients there and prevent them from reaching rivers and lakes. They're used as conservation tools in the Midwest. And so certainly they can help capture those nutrients. And when you get rid of them, you lose those sources of capture.
What happens when the nutrient levels get too high if nutrient pollution goes unchecked?
So then you have things, drinking water problems. So you have nitrate in drinking water, specifically above 10 milligrams per liter, which causes some really grave public health concerns. The thing that people are most familiar with is blue baby syndrome, which can cause, in the most severe cases, the death of infants. When you have nutrient surges in lakes and rivers, you have algae blooms, sometimes toxic algae blooms with neurotoxins.
And that's when you get those dead zones.
Absolutely.
In the Gulf,
mm-hmm.
Which now the dead zone is about the size of New Jersey.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
Huge.
Huge, yeah.
Yeah, and so where are you seeing movement? What have or what can governments do to clean up water? Where do you see movement?
So there's great movement, and I take issue with the idea that we're not doing anything to address the problem. We're not doing enough. I think we need to scale up some of the successes that we're seeing at the local level and at the state level and at the federal level, and better integrate our efforts. So throughout the Mississippi River Basin, states are developing and implementing what are called nutrient reduction strategies. Wisconsin developed its nutrient reduction strategy in 2013 and released an update progress report to that strategy in 2017. And that document kind of outlines a lot of great efforts that are ongoing in Wisconsin to address nutrients, voluntary efforts, regulatory efforts, and how those efforts, and they're really existing programs that we've been working with for a long time, but how efforts within those programs have been ramped up and integrated to try and meet the scale of the threat that we now face.
When I think of nutrients, I naturally think of farm runoff.
Yep.
I don't think of my own pollution that I'm contributing. I'm thinking of farmers and what they're putting on their fields. Have we seen, you know, businesses and farms work together on different strategies with their crops and when they apply things to their crops?
Yeah, I think farmers are making a good effort in a lot of places. I think some of the most exciting kind of collaborative efforts with farmers are what I like to call municipal agricultural partnerships. So one of the most prominent of those partnerships in Wisconsin is in the Rock River watershed and in the Ahara sub-watershed. So right here in Madison, you have Madison Metropolitan Sewerage District, and I think 23 or 24 municipal partners and state partners and federal partners working with farmers to reduce nutrient pollution in the watershed. And it's a really successful and exciting effort, and it's something that the federal EPA is looking to spread across the country.
Talking with Jamie Konopacki, she's an attorney and watershed policy specialist. We're looking at nutrient runoff in the Mississippi River and what cities and communities are doing about it, where it comes from. What is your story about the Mississippi River? Do you live along the river? Are you concerned about runoff? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jamie, when I think of the Mississippi River, I often think of my time in Baton Rouge and looking at the mouth of the Mississippi, and you can go up and look at the Mississippi River at the levee in Baton Rouge, and I'm always so apologetic to the Mississippi because at that point, it's all refineries right along the banks. There is a lot of port action, and it's all about oil refining. Mm-hmm. And I don't see what the river has actually had to deal with further up, that there is a lot of nutrients in the water and there's been all of this other stuff going on before it finally gets to the mouth, and now it's got to deal with with oil refinery. I mean, this river is resilient.
It is resilient. I mean, it's the largest watershed in the U.S. It's draining parts or all of, I think, 31 or 32 states. It's massive. So it's absorbing a lot, but nature is strong, powerful, resilient, like you're saying. So it's put up with a lot. But what we can see is that there's a breaking point for everything. And the dead zone in the Gulf, it's just the same thing that we're seeing in Wisconsin and Iowa and states throughout the Midwest. You know, we see the same algae blooms and pollutions. There is a breaking point in nature eventually, and it's harder to tell when you're working with such a large system, but we have a pretty good indicator that we need to do better upstream.
10 years ago, the EPA tasked states along the Mississippi to cut pollution by 45% in hopes of dealing with the dead zone in the Gulf. And an investigation recently by the Iowa Gazette found out that progress is minimal. What did you think about that study?
So it was a pretty high-level look at the nutrient reduction strategies, and that's what I was referring to earlier. I think that there has been success. It's really hard to read those documents without a really solid understanding of the underlying programs that the states are using. So in Wisconsin, to implement our nutrient reduction strategy, we're using things like total maximum daily loads, which people are somewhat familiar with. They're kind of pollution diets for water bodies. We're using Section 319 plans, which are a different type of watershed plan where you're working with agricultural producers to identify measurable milestones and reduce pollution in smaller areas. We're using permits for municipal wastewater treatment plants and also municipal stormwater areas. And all of those programs are slowly chipping away at this problem. But I think it's going to require a lot more funding, integration of effort to get to where we need to go. So I think there is progress, but it's the devil's in the details.
Attorney and watershed policy consultant Jamie Konopacki stays with us. Your insights are welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you live along the Mississippi River? Have you seen the environment change over the years? If you're a farmer, what steps do you take to limit runoff? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation, perhaps hear from you in just a minute on the Ideas Network. Nitrate and phosphorus from industry and agriculture have created a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. It's this area of low oxygen that can kill fish and marine life. It's about the size of New Jersey. And there are researchers all over the place who are working to try to reverse the harmful effects of this water pollution. with better nutrient management and tillage and use of cover crops. We're looking at next steps and what options are on the table. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Attorney Jamie Konopacki is a watershed policy specialist. We're gathering your insights and your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. What concerns do you have about water quality in Wisconsin? How should it be measured and regulated? You can call in or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Jamie, let's go back for just a moment here and create a really good understanding of the difference between nitrogen and phosphorus.
Sure. So when it comes to growing crops, they're both vitally important nutrients for crops. They help, you know, strong stems, good leaves, strong roots. The main difference is kind of how they behave in water. And what scientists have told us is that when we're looking at what is the potential for water pollution, we need to look at what is the limiting nutrient in a water body. And when you look at inland lakes and rivers, like in Wisconsin, in those surface water systems, phosphorus is generally the limiting nutrient. And down in the Gulf, we're talking about nitrogen being the limiting nutrient. Another important distinction is that phosphorus pollution usually binds to soil and is carried off into surface waters. There is also a soluble component, but there's a strong insoluble component of phosphorus, so it's going across the surface. And nitrate is really water soluble, so it becomes a groundwater issue. It leaches through especially the porous sandy soils we have in the center of the state, and certainly through the bedrock cracks that we have kind of in a V along the edges and the bottom of the state here in Wisconsin. So
which should we be more concerned about at this point?
Both. Unfortunately, both. You can't, you definitely can't pick one or the other. The surface water blooms are, you know, increasingly of growing concern, in particular because of those cyanotoxins that I was talking about earlier. We know very little about a whole bunch of these scary neurotoxins that can pop up in those surface water blooms that are caused by phosphorus. And nitrate is a huge issue in this state. We just saw, you know, a well study in the Southwest, and unfortunately one infant has, you know, already died because of nitrate pollution in our groundwater here. I think in 2017, I think we had about 50 community wells that were over the standard for nitrate. It's scary.
So let's look at possible solutions here. What is the role of the EPA in all of this?
So at the federal level, I think both the EPA and the USDA are incredibly important. So we have a whole bunch of federal, state, and local programs that all have to work together to address the issue. EPA can do important technical support for modeling and developing of models, for instance. They can provide essential support at also to the states. And states do a lot of working on monitoring, modeling, and support at the local level. USDA is also really important entity to look at. So USDA and NRCS are responsible for implementing the conservation programs in the Farm Bill. And there is a lot of dollars and technical expertise housed in that agency as well. That's critical. At the state level here, we provide a lot of dollars through state programs for working with farmers on conservation. But we also rely a lot on those federal programs. So we need to make sure that they're working together in the most efficient way possible to address the challenges as quickly as possible.
And a challenge in one place of the watershed may be different than another place. It seems like there are so many different issues going on and not one size fits all.
Absolutely. There's not one size fits all, but there is, I think, a general framework that we can take from watershed to watershed. So through the 319 program, for instance, that's a program under the Clean Water Act that specifically aims at helping address non-point pollution. They've established a framework for watershed planning. And so it's essentially things like, let's look at the land base that we're working with, try to identify the sources of contamination, try to identify what's the total load in terms of pounds or tons of phosphorus or sediment that we're seeing. Let's identify measurable milestones and then have a plan for education and outreach and tracking and monitoring. So you can take that type of plan and then tools for mapping out conservation practices in a watershed, and you can put them together and you can come up with an idea of how much funding and how many people you're going to need on the ground in a small local watershed to address a problem. And my theory is that it's really important to concentrate on these local planning efforts and balance the planning with the implementation. We don't want to just develop more plans that sit on the shelf. So definitely different, but I think we have a common framework for analysis and identifying what the priorities should be.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Brian joining us from Rochester, Minnesota. Brian, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just wondering, as consumers, what we can do differently. Anything we can we change our purchasing habits, for example, to help out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that there, for a long time, have been entities, big food producers, stores that are looking through the supply chain to encourage agricultural producers to use better practices. We've seen that for a long time with water quantity, Coca-Cola doing a lot of work to message that they're a company that's looking to reduce their water usage, so you should buy their product over maybe Pepsi because they're doing water quantity efforts. That's newer and evolving in water quality. So hopefully someday we get to the point where we have, green stars or green corn cobs, on products that are produced from areas where there are practices, sustainable practices on the ground. We haven't seen, I don't think, enough of that yet to, as consumers point to one product versus the other. But I think as local citizens, getting involved with the water protection planning for your local source of your local public water supply is a really important thing that folks can do.
So a recent study found that 42% of private wells in southwest Wisconsin are contaminated, exceeding acceptable limits of bacteria or nitrates.
Mm-hmm.
So what is going on there, and what type of action needs to take place to reverse that?
Yeah, so we have an interesting karst topography that kind of makes a V shape around the state of Wisconsin. And so we also saw some new targeted rules along the eastern part of the state because it has the same type of vulnerable bedrock structure. Essentially, cracks in this bedrock create super highways where if you have manure, the bacteria and the nitrates from manure and the fertilizer can go right down to the groundwater table, which is, of course, where our public wells are. So that's what we have going on. It's nitrates filtering down through some pretty permeable underlying bedrock. And contaminating water supplies.
And so are there specific plans to address that? Because these are private wells, private citizens,
yeah.
Their own wells on their own property.
Well, and they're private wells and public wells. Like I said earlier, I think in 2017 we had 50 public water supplies attested above. So it's really challenging because the onus is on you if you have a private well to be testing your well. And I had a private well growing up. I know we didn't test our well. Representative Voss has said that he plans to commence a task force on the issue. I think the incoming administration has expressed a lot of support for ramping up science efforts and funding at the
incoming DNR. Governor Tony Evers.
Correct. Yeah.
Administration.
Yeah.
So do you see glimpses of hope there in terms of the funding you need in order to bring these programs to fruition?
Glimpses, yes, but I think concerned citizens need to hold elected representatives and Tony Evers' new administration hold the feet to the fire because it's reaching catastrophic proportions in Wisconsin. And I think that the pollution has been on the uptick for a while now, but these studies really make clear that we've got a big and serious problem.
Wisconsin is known for its agriculture. It has dairy. It has CAFOs. How have farmers here adapted to water policies and practices? Is Wisconsin taking a lead?
Yeah, I think Wisconsin is still taking a lead. CAFOs are managed differently in Wisconsin and across the country under the Clean Water Act than smaller operations. So CAFOs, by definition, are about 1,000 animal units or more, and they have permits just like municipal sewage treatment plants have permits under the Clean Water Act. In those permits, they're required to do nutrient management planning to identify the land acres where they're going to spread manure. But it's really challenging. And as a result of Midwest Environmental Advocates' petition, I think back in 2015 to EPA, we had EPA come in and kind of do some investigations. So DNR got 4 new staff for that CAFO program because it's a lot of work. I think we now have around 300 CAFOs in the state. each of those operations, I think, if you look at the report from Wisconsin Land and Water here, they can have like 12 million gallons of manure each operation per year to spread. So they need like 2,000 acres. So making clear that there's sufficient acres where these operations can haul and spread that manure without having this threat that it's going to be spread in areas where it's going to penetrate down to the water table and contaminate. It's a big job. You know, we have to work together to do it. But yeah, I think that we have strong programs in the state, and we are continuing to try and lead.
In the last few seconds we have with you, if you could leave us with one thing we could do today to help improve water quality in the Mississippi River, what would it be?
I say just get involved and pick a way to get involved. If your primary concern is nitrate in your drinking water supply, then you can get involved with what's called source water assessment and protection planning in your community. Be aware of where your watershed is and what the threats to your surface and groundwater are, and be a part of the solution at the local level.
Jamie, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Jamie Konopacki is an attorney and watershed policy specialist who works on partnerships that decrease nutrient pollution. She's worked with the city of Green Bay, was a fellow at Harvard, where she worked with governments along the Eastern Seaboard and published on watershed solutions. Coming up next, winter does a number on our skin. We'll talk with a dermatologist about how to take care of it. Do you change the way you care for your skin in the winter? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.